Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Stephanie Caden. I am the director of the Levine Family Humanitarian Studies Initiative, which is the professional education arm of the Humanitarian Academy at Harvard. And in that role, I train not only graduate students, but also humanitarian workers from around the world in humanitarian response, both in conflict zones and outside of them. Before I get started, can I see how many of you have worked in a conflict zone or a humanitarian crisis setting? Excellent. I have no conflict of interest to disclose. Okay, so those of you who have worked in these settings, you know that international disasters are quite different from the disasters that we face domestically. There are often language and cultural issues. Most of the time, you're dealing with episodes of mass displacement, large movements of populations forced away from their homes. There very commonly is conflict, no matter what caused the disaster. Sometimes conflict is the disaster that you're dealing with, but sometimes, and in fact, relatively often, we are faced with a natural disaster in a conflict zone. So think of the tsunami in Indonesia and in Banda Aceh. There's very commonly poor accessibility, and there's often insecurity. And of course, unlike in some kinds of domestic disasters, which is what a lot of US physicians know, there are special coordination structures that one really needs to know if you're going to be involved in international disaster response. Now, I mentioned briefly coordination. It's almost the most important thing to know about. Because what we do know about humanitarian workers these days is that directed violence is the number one killer of these workers. Used to be road traffic accidents. But nowadays it's violence. And so if we do not teach our workers how to deal with conflict situations in their health relief work, we're really doing them a disservice. So when most people think of going to an international disaster or crisis zone, we get a lot of this kind of thing. Doctors who show up in a disaster area and just want to help, okay? And what we try to avoid is people just doing the cowboy approach and going by themselves, because that doesn't often turn out very well. The first thing is that in a lot of these disaster zones, the most heavy need for actual medical intervention is all taken care of and done by the first 72 hours or so in most disasters. So that means that people who come from another country are already going to be arriving too late to do any good. Even in those natural disasters where there is a heavy need for doctors, such as earthquakes, where there's a lot of broken bones and neurosurgical type traumas, those doctors actually, when they come by themselves, they eat up a lot of local resources, okay? They often don't come planned to house themselves or feed themselves. And they end up draining a lot of the resources locally that would otherwise go to the survivors. And so what we really need are doctors who preferably join a large NGO, and even better, are trained in public health measures. Because in these situations of mass displacement in conflict and disasters, it's really the public health measures that are the thing that saves lives, more than the medical measures in most cases. So we need doctors who are trained in public health, trained in humanitarian work. Otherwise, they're more of a drain than they are a help. So how does one prepare professionally to work within the larger structure of international disaster response? That's what we're going to talk about now. We're going to talk about professional preparation and personal preparation for the field. The first thing you have to know professionally is how the system works. You need to know the players in international disaster response work. You need to know about the UN cluster approach. This is how the United Nations organizes this international response to large-scale disasters. And you need to know the international standards and guidelines for providing help in these situations. And one of the common standards and guidelines is the SPHERE standards, which we'll go over in a moment. So who are the players? In general, of all the people you meet in a disaster zone, they're probably going to fall into one of these four categories of helpers. The UN is the first category. The United Nations has the job of coordinating all of the international disaster response from all sides. And it uses the cluster system, or the cluster approach to do that. We'll look at that in a moment. The second type of person you'll see in the field are representatives of government agencies. In this case, JICA. For the U.S., it would be USAID. For the British, it would be DFID. But these are the organizations, these governments, that provide most of the funding for the work that's done in the field. All right. So not so much direct help, but the funding. Very important, right? Because if you have no funding, you have no mission. Now, the people who do most of the work are the non-governmental organizations, like Doctors Without Borders or Oxfam, Save the Children, and the International Rescue Committee. Those are the people who are actually doing a lot of this work in the field. And last, but certainly these days not least, we see a lot more military involvement. Now, this can be a national military of the country where the conflict is, if they're not the cause of the conflict in the first place. But increasingly, international militaries are strengthening their humanitarian arms. We certainly see that in the United States, where the U.S. military has made it one of its key tenets of action is now humanitarian work. And so they're putting many more resources in. And the U.S. does that. Canada is there often. The British, the Israelis are among the best at this kind of work. But there are several other international militaries that do this, and what they will do is provide large-scale logistical help in the field. Helicopters, large transports, they rebuild bridges. There's a lot of things they can do that humanitarians now need to know how to work with. This is a slide that shows the UN cluster approach. And what the cluster approach is, as you can see, there are slices of the pie around the edges, and those are the different sectors of activity through which disaster response is given. You see, those of us, we belong right up at the top there in health. And the lead agency for health is the World Health Organization. That makes sense. But you can see the different sectors. What people need to know before they go into the field is not only what their sector does, but how to access each sector once you get into the field so that you can coordinate with them and create a coordinated response. And this is partly how you do that. So this is, you can see the date at the top, January 15th, 2010. This is just a couple days after the earthquake in Haiti. And this was a little sign that shows the schedule of cluster meetings on the door of UN OCHA, which is the coordinating body in the field, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. And so if you know about this, you can walk up to the UN headquarters, find this list, and start to attend these cluster meetings and be part of the coordinated response. If you don't know about this, then you do not show up at these cluster meetings, and you are a rogue player, essentially, and are not part of a coordinated international response. If we don't coordinate, that leads to a lot of duplication, a lot of missed areas of aid, and it's really hard to figure out who's helping all the different people in all the different places. We saw a lot of this lack of coordination in Haiti, but I can tell you that it's a recurring problem in a lot of disaster zones, whether it's conflict-based or not. Now, we mentioned international guidelines. The most important international guideline are the SPHERE standards. This is a consensus document that's updated every several years, and inside you have the first thing you have is a three-page document that's really worth a read called the Humanitarian Charter. We'll look at that in a minute, but the Humanitarian Charter is really gives us the mandate and the authority to do work overseas based on international documents. Then there are a set of protection principles and core standards before you get into the water, sanitation, and hygiene standards called WASH, and then there are standards for food, shelter, and health. It's sort of the Bible of international disaster response, and it's downloadable for free from the sphereproject.org website. Now, the Humanitarian Charter, this small three-page document, is based on a collection of principles from international humanitarian law, which is the law of war, or for those of you who may have studied it, the Geneva Conventions, and some other international laws, the Code of Conduct from the Red Cross, and the body of human rights law. And so this three-page document distills from all of these sources some major principles which guide the humanitarian work, which are really important for each person to know. The right to life with dignity, the right to receive humanitarian assistance, and the right to protection and security. Further into the SPHERE standard book, you get what are called standards. Now, these standards are written generally, are meant to be sort of broad reaching. So, for example, in the water sanitation hygiene section, one of the standards is that all people have safe and equitable access to a sufficient quantity of water, and it goes on to say for bathing, cooking, drinking, etc. That's what standards look like. Indicators have numbers attached to them. And indicators can vary depending on the situation, but they give guideposts to the responder to know when they're doing the right job or not. So that looks more like a minimum requirement of 15 liters of clean water per person per day, one latrine per every 20 people in an emergency situation, and so on and so on. Now, that's the professional preparation. What can people do personally? Well, the first thing is you have to plan for self-sufficiency. You have to absolutely know that when you go out there, no one is going to be there to rescue you. That's sort of the point, right? Because you're there to help relieve and rescue others. It's really important for individuals to know that they have to plan for not only providing the medical help, but their transportation, their own housing, food, water, their use of electricity. So if you plan to take a laptop or a mobile phone, how are you going to recharge that? That's your responsibility or the responsibility of the organization you're with, but you better make sure that you have a way of doing that. Your own communications, the medical supplies you need. Again, the best thing is to go with an organization like a major NGO, but if you don't do that, you are absolutely in charge of making sure that you bring what you need to do the relief job. A lot of surgeons and anesthesiologists who showed up in Haiti, for example, without any anesthetic, ketamine. You know, and so I don't know what they expected, but they expected to go to Haiti, do some surgery without any anesthetic. That's obviously not to anybody's international standard. You have to take care of your own personal comfort. The comfort items that you bring along with you help to relieve stress, help to keep you functional, and you need to think about that before you go. And of course, security and evacuation plans. This is, again, one of your responsibilities as a responder. It's important to stay flexible. Even if you're a medical worker, doctor, nurse, public health professional, you need to be ready to offer non-medical help. This is a picture from a field hospital that myself and a colleague set up in Haiti. And this is Rodney, as you can see. And Rodney's job is, I lift heavy things. Rodney was my favorite person. I would have traded 50 doctors that I had on staff for Rodney because he was able to string electrical wiring through the camp and to set up tents and to move supplies, and he did us all a great favor. I had a number of surgeons who were there just to operate, and if it didn't have to do with a knife, they weren't interested. And honestly, that wasn't very useful. The other thing to remember is that in a crisis situation, things are going to change minute by minute. So expect that to happen. Expect the leaders to have to reprioritize every moment. You have to accept your lack of control over that situation. There is a little bit of chaos involved, but you have to know to expect that and not to let it throw you off track. And of course, keep an open mind. Probably the biggest thing you need to do is, though, expect stress. There are long hours. You want to make sure you see the warning signs of stress, not only in yourself, but also in others. You want to make sure you eat, that you sleep, that you get exercise. A lot of people fall into a trap of trying to work 24 hours a day because this is an emergency and a crisis, and that is absolutely the wrong thing. Keep a sense of humor. When you see these stress responses in others, make sure you realize why they're yelling at you and soften your response to their behaviors. And you want to keep a sense of social order. Just be polite. Say please, say thank you, say good job. It really matters to keep a sense of normal social order with people, because if you fall into the trap of thinking this is a war zone, all the rules don't apply, things spiral downhill from there very, very quickly. What to take? This is not meant to be readable, but there are a long list of things that you are responsible. This is not even the full list. If you want this list, my email is on the last slide. Email me and I'll send you our list of what to take to a disaster zone. But of all the things on the list, it's there to promote your own self-sufficiency and your comfort. Do not forget your comfort items, whatever they are. Chocolate, chewing gum, pictures of your family, your music. That is also a major part of what to take to a disaster zone. And my last point is, you need to find a training program. Humanitarian response is now a professional body of knowledge that you need to know, just like you need to know about public health if you're going to do public health work, just like you need to know about surgery if you plan to take someone's appendix out. Do not find yourself in a situation of going to one of these zones without some of this training. There are many programs to choose from. The HELP course, Health Emergencies and Large Populations course, run by the ICRC in different locations around the world, is a very good course. I happen to run one here at Harvard that's open to anyone to take every April, and that's called the Humanitarian Response Intensive Course, and these are some pictures from that. And in that course, we do 10 days of classroom work with desktop simulation, but then we take all of our students out for 3 days of field simulation in the woods. And these days we have about 250 people in the woods for 3 days solid, and they learn from some of the top trainers in the business. They not only learn about water, sanitation, hygiene, and healthcare, but they also learn very practical field skills, leadership, how to manage stress. We have professional aggression trainers that come over from the Netherlands to nudge and press and stress our students in the field. They're taught media skills by a professional BBC cameraman. And so during this simulation, they're on camera. That's him in the bottom left. And they will be on a news report later on. So what we try to focus on in these 3 days is not only the basics of humanitarian response, but also these sort of high-impact, low-probability events that humanitarians will face in conflict zones today. So I have a couple of resources there. They'll be on the slides that I think will be available to you. And we will take questions, I think, after the next presenter. Thanks.